Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. We first look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. This is an article from Lauren Steffi from the Houston Chronicle, and it's about Time Magazine. It says, Time Magazine misses the boat on the person of the year. Time Magazine blew it. Last week, it named Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke as its person of the year. The news magazine said it picked the Money Dome because he took bold action to forestall a depression. In terms of influence and how the economy went this year, Bernanke was the guy, according to the Time managing editor, Richard Stengel, speaking with Bloomberg News. Now, I'll agree that the Fed's actions did, indeed, keep us all out of the breadline, but it took many of those steps last year. This year, Bernanke has been the guy who turned the Fed into a political football, who's taken it to the brink of congressional oversight, and who sought to maintain its turf as a banking regulator, even as he backed policies to support the too-big-to-fail syndrome that helped us get into this mess. So, I've decided to name my own person of the year, Elizabeth Warren. Warren is a voice of reason, rising over the din of politics. A common sense watchdog, she is the closest thing that most of us have to a true representative in this bailout process, which may be why so few in Washington seem to pay attention to her. This year, Warren has led the Congressional Oversight Panel charged with monitoring the Troubled Asset Relief Program. It was her panel that issued the critical report that found while TARP may have helped avert a depression, it also turned the entire financial industry into a permanent ward of the government. Warren has consistently rallied against the unwillingness of federal regulators, including Bernanke's Fed, to address the too big to fail. A Harvard law professor, she has spent years writing and researching credit problems and economic stress. She is perhaps best known for co-authoring with her daughter The Two-Income Trap, which analyzed household spending patterns and found that modern families were worse off than those a generation ago, even though more now have two breadwinners. When Alan Greenspan ran the Fed, Warren wrote him letters asking how he planned to address the huge debt that Americans were piling up. She asked members of Congress the same thing. She never got any answers. A Republican who grew up on a farm in Oklahoma, Warren also fought against adoption of the 2005 Bankruptcy Reform Bill, which was dubbed the No Lender Left Behind Act, because it essentially absolved credit card companies of responsibility for predatory practices. In an essay she co-authored for the Stanford Law Review in 2006, Warren warned that banks' attitudes had changed so dramatically since the Great Depression that we no longer had to worry about customers making a run on the banks, but rather banks making a run on the customers. They were using so many fees and gimmicks to exploit the most vulnerable customers that it was driving many into foreclosure, default, and bankruptcy. Ruining customers would result in the collapse of the banking system as surely as ruining the banks, she warned. That was 3 years and more than 100 bank failures ago. Since being tapped by Congress to keep an eye on the TARP this year, Warren has warned that banks aren't as healthy as they're saying they are, and she voiced concerns that the worst of the problems with smaller banks may not be over. Once again, Washington is telling her to talk to the hand. For most of this decade, Warren has been right. She has sounded the alarm early and often, and she's been ignored. She herself noted in testimony earlier this year that the Treasury Department was brushing off her latest concerns about the banking industry. We ignore her at our own peril. The money dome may be the guy with influence, but time will show that, once again, this year, Warren was the person with insight. And again, that was from the Houston Chronicle, Lauren Steffi. It's also interesting to note that last week, Elizabeth Warren was chosen the Bostonian of the year. Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard Law professor who has been very much in the limelight this year for chairing the Congressional Oversight Panel overseeing the TARP bailout program and for originating the idea of a federal consumer financial protection agency, has been named the Bostonian of the year by the Boston Globe. It seemed as if the banks and other firms got a $7 billion bonanza and the American taxpayer got the shaft. But along came this straight-shooting Harvard professor to oversee the bailout, someone who pledged to look out for the middle class and brought a sense of sanity to the economic crisis. For this, we give her our top honors this year. For someone born and raised in Oklahoma, to be named Bostonian of the Year is quite an honor. But this is someone who has already this year been named to Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world, and who blogger Matt Taibbi has urged be drafted to run for president in 2012. She's pushed for transparency in the Fed, is openly furious about the misuse of bailout money, and seems to take personally the chicanery that credit card companies and banks use to game the suckers out there, Taibbi argues. Again, Elizabeth Warren, Bostonian of the Year. And if you thought 36% interest on a credit card was bad, how about 79.9% interest? It sounds crazy, but it's true. Thank you, South Dakota. South Dakota opened the floodgates for banks to charge these outrageous loan shark interest rates. Now, First Premier Bank is taking it to a new high, or should we say low. It's an effort to avoid new fee regulations being posted against credit card companies starting in February. It sure didn't take long for First Premier to figure out a way to get around the new government regulatory caps. And rest assured, many of the other subprime lenders are sure to follow in this direction to skirt the new law. First Premier Bank charges a variety of annual and first-year fees, account setup fees, program fee, annual fee, and monthly servicing fee. The total cost of first-year fees on a new cardholder comes to $256. The new regulations will cap these fees at 25% of a cardholder's credit line and reduce the bank's fees to a maximum of $75 on a credit line of $300. To offset this loss, First Premier Bank decided to make use of the fact that the new regulations did not cap the interest rate they can charge. They have recently issued cards with fees of $75 and an interest rate of 79.9%. There will also be a $29 late fee and over credit limit fee. First Premier Bank. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's go back to The Two-Income Trap, which is a book by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, which investigates why middle-class parents are going broke. And as Time magazine stated, a startling account of the elusiveness of the American dream. Over the last couple of months, we've been using this as a textbook and looking deeply into analyzing the current state of the financial challenges for middle-class people. I need to start out stating that We do give credit to the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs because they are directly from or based on the work theories and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are really two of America's leading champions for debtors. And I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and the Two-Income Trap. And it would be useful to go back to the archives at www.kruufm.com and look in the Life and Debt section so you can listen to all of the programs we have produced to help you deal with debt and all of your finances. Last week, I ended on the discussion of the cost of college and how that has impacted on middle-class people. Again, you can go back to that show and listen to it. But in the final analysis, we discussed whether it was time for a tuition freeze. As I mentioned, whenever the problem of college costs are discussed, most conservative policymakers typically focus on making more loans available to families. But as Professor Warren indicates, can we say that this is really a solution? Data-wise, by the turn of the century, over 5 million students had borrowed $34 billion in just 2001 in federal student loans, more than triple the amount borrowed just 10 years earlier. Students borrowing from private lenders has grown even faster, and that's been increasing fivefold in just 6 years. Of course, it's not just the college students that bear the burden, because parents are going deep into debt to pay for their children's education. Every year, more than 1 million families take out a second mortgage on their homes just to pay for educational expenses. And as I mentioned, this did have a very major impact on the foreclosure crisis that we are seeing. People went from fixed mortgage rates to adjustable mortgage rates, and it got out of hand, and they were incapable of paying for mortgages they had paid for without difficulty for decades. It's important to clearly realize that borrowing does not reduce the costs. It simply means that families can pay and pay and pay some more, and with the refinancing choice, can lose their home. So, Professor Warren says, at what point do we agree that families have taken on all the debt they can handle? The debt load tripled in the past decade. Do we intend to let it triple again over the next decade? It's like throwing rocks to a drowning man when you offer more debt to a family that is already underwater in debt. It won't help. On the other side, those people who we call liberals regularly call on taxpayers to foot more of the bill. But taxpayers are already paying more. Over the past two decades, states increased per pupil appropriations to public universities by 13%, adjusted for inflation. So how much more are taxpayers supposed to pay? Are state governments supposed to write a blank check for higher education, allowing universities to increase costs with abandon? College administrators point out that a 13% increase in public funding fell far short of the 41% growth in university expenditures, which is why they were forced to raise the tuition so much. That may be true, but that simply says we're spending more than the state will give us, so we pass the cost on to the families. This is not an endorsement of the frugality of the current system. So the more taxes approach suffers from basically the same problem the more debt approach engenders. It gives colleges more money to spend without any attempt to control their spiraling costs. Professor Warren suggests it's time to shake things up with a hold on price increases. A multi-year freeze on tuition at all state universities would prompt an intensive discussion of higher education priorities and some hard choices. Do they all want to offer expensive sports programs? Should some colleges concentrate on science and engineering while others focus on liberal arts? Should universities be asked to educate more students in exchange for additional tax dollars? This approach would certainly hit the supply and demand problem right between the eyes. If all state-supported universities were committed to stopping the tuition increases, the effects would reverberate throughout the educational system. Many public colleges might rededicate themselves to serving their local communities, dropping out of the arms race for ephemeral national prestige. The pressure would be on private colleges to follow suit because the gap between private and public tuitions would grow even larger. The upward spiral of tuition and the resulting "it's not our fault, everyone else is doing it" mentality would receive a serious thrashing. Colleges and universities are like any other organism in their desire for survival and growth, according to the professor. Their leaders are true believers in the research and scholarly mission of their schools and their desire for excellence. However it is measured among universities, it's genuine. It is no wonder that they can always justify their rising costs and why they need every penny that comes their way, and more. There can always be more research, more athletic fields, more books for the library. To be sure, the issues are complex, and a spending freeze might force some universities to make some very tough choices. In the long run, it would refocus public universities on their mission, providing an education for all qualified members of the public, not just those who can come up with $10,000 or $20,000 each year. So in the past, we looked at the additional costs of preschool education for the middle class, and then the taxing costs of college education for middle class families, and how, in fact, we can see these are hurting families tremendously. But there have been some solutions offered by Professor Warren and her daughter, Amelia, to offset the challenges. So what's the next part of the two-income trap? Well, it's the family car. Not all of the extra income brought in by mom's paycheck went to that house in the suburbs and preschool and college tuition. A lot of it went to another line item in the family budget, a favorite target of the overconsumption critics, that shiny, oversized, over-gadgeted behemoth, the family car. Professor Warren, when she started analyzing this, at first thought that the family car might shatter her case against the overconsumption myth. Cars now come jam-packed with automatic gizmos that no one had ever dreamed of a generation ago, and cars cost more than ever. I frequently have clients who, husband and wife, have over $75,000 worth of loans on cars. And these are middle-class people who purchased $80,000 or $90,000 worth of cars, two cars. The average family now spends an additional $4,000 inflation-adjusted every year to buy, lease, and maintain the family automobiles. In the words of a Toyota salesman quoted in Affluenza, people's expectations are much higher. They want amenities, power steering, power brakes, a standard premium sound system, and on and on. At last, a big ticket item that proves Americans are indeed indulging themselves with lavish extravagances they can ill afford. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'm currently discussing the overconsumption myth, component of the two-income trap, and specifically the family car and the cost of that. And Professor Warren was looking at the big-ticket item, which tends to prove that people in the middle class are indulging themselves with extravagances. But her response was, families do spend more, but not because they are upgrading to leather and built-in seat warmers. Instead, the typical family with children spent its money on something a bit more prosaic, a second car. Once an unheard of luxury within the middle class, the second car has become a necessity. With mom in the workforce and the family located farther from the city center, that second car became the only means for running errands, earning a second income, and getting by in a far-flung suburban neighborhood. And what about the price tag on that second car? An average new car costs more than $22,000 today, compared with less than $16,000 in the late 70s, inflation adjusted. And the critics might point a triumphant finger, but they would miss another important fact. Cars last longer than they used to. In the late 1970s, the average car on the road was just 5.5 years old. Now, the average family is driving a car that is more than 8 years old. Today's families pay more for that shiny new vehicle than their parents did, but they hold on to it a bit longer. In fact, when Professor Warren analyzed unpublished data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, she found that the average amount a family of four spends per car, car payments, insurance, maintenance, and so forth, 20% less than it was spending a generation ago. For all the griping about those overpriced SUVs, there is little evidence that sunroofs and power windows are sending families to the poorhouse, according to Professor Warren. She says leather interiors may not be responsible for the rise in bankruptcies, but the overconsumption camp might still argue that families could have saved by buying cheaper cars. After all, a family doesn't need a new SUV with a CD player, at least not in the same way that it needs decent daycare or a home in a safe neighborhood. But we pause here to offer a bit of sympathy for the much maligned buyer of the family car. As she points out, the din from the car industry has changed pitch over the past generation. If you look at an advertisement from any maker of family cars, and there you'll see it, safety for sale. This testimonial is featured on the official Volvo website. The driver of the truck lost control of his vehicle and hit me and my wife, who was 5 months pregnant. There was much talk that the Volvo had saved our lives, and I'm convinced it did. I wish to thank the people at Volvo for the lives of my wife and my child. Sure, maybe families could do without the 12-speaker sound systems, but we wouldn't ask them to do without the automatic braking systems, the crash-resistant steel frames, or the dual airbags that they are spending all that money on. So then Professor Warren asks, do cars have to be so big? SUVs drink gasoline with abandon, but families are also buying room for safety devices that didn't even exist in the early 1970s. Safety standards have changed with a real effect on the family pocketbook. For example, there's those safety seats for kids where by law you have to use them, and they do cost some substantial money, often up to $100. But the real expenditure was for the car itself. When there are babies in the family, for example, people often replace the car that they had for a four-door car big enough for a couple of car seats for the kids. And sometimes there's a number of kids in the family, so the vehicle has to be bigger. So people do opt for minivans and Suburbans. Critics may be right that families don't need all those gizmos in their cars, but it is true that people need room and they need safety within that room. Professor Warren does conclude that families have spent prudently on their automobiles, or at least as prudently as they did a generation ago, and the money they are spending is paying off. Statistically, the rate of child auto fatalities has declined steadily since the mid-1970s, thanks, at least in part, to safer cars and better car seats. For all the criticism hurled at car manufacturers and car buyers, it is important to note that families drive stronger, safer cars that lasts a lot longer than they used to. So let's look at families then and families now, the two-income trap time. Professor Warren starts adding it all up. Families are working harder, and thanks to mom's income, they're making more money than ever before, and yet they are spending more too. So where does that leave the typical working family? Professor Warren and Amelia give some examples. She begins with Tom and Susan, representatives of the average middle-class family of a generation ago. And once again, all the figures that I will talk about are adjusted for inflation throughout the discussion. So Tom works full-time, earning $38,700. The median income for a fully employed man in 1973, while Susan stays at home to care for the house and the children. Tom and Susan have two typical children, one in grade school and a three-year-old who stays home with Susan. The family buys health insurance through Tom's job, to which they contribute $1,030 a year, the average amount spent by an insured family that made at least some contributions to the cost of private insurance policies. They own an average home in an average family neighborhood, costing them about $5,310 a year in mortgage payments. Shopping is within walking distance, so the family owns just one car, on which it spends $5,140 a year for car payments, maintenance, gas, and repairs. And like all good citizens, they pay their taxes, which claims about 24% of Tom's income. Once all the taxes, mortgage payments, and other fixed expenses are paid, Tom and Susan are left with $17,834 in discretionary income, inflation adjusted, or about 46% of Tom's pre-tax check. They aren't rich, but they have nearly $1,500 a month to cover food, clothing, utilities, and anything else they might need. So this is 1973. How does 1973 compare with the example Professor Warren gives of Justin and Kimberly, the modern-day version of the traditional family? Like Tom, Justin is an average earner, bringing home $39,000 at the turn of the century, not even 1% more than his counterpart of a generation ago. But there is one big difference. Thanks to Kimberly's full-time salary, the family's combined income is $67,800, a whopping 75% higher than the household income for Tom and Susan. A quick look at their income statement shows how the modern dual-income couple has sailed past the single-income counterpart of a generation ago. 67.8 versus 38.7, 75% higher. So where did all the money go? Justin and Kimberly bought an average home, but today the three-bedroom, two-bath ranch costs a lot more. Their annual mortgage payments are nearly $9,000 a year rather than the $5,300. The older child still goes to public elementary school, but after school and during summer vacations, he goes to daycare at an average yearly cost of $4,350. The younger child attends a full-time preschool daycare program, which costs the family $5,320 a year. With Kimberly at work, the second car is a must, so the family spends more than $8,000 a year on its two vehicles. Health insurance is another must, and even when Justin's employer picks up a big share of the cost, insurance takes $1,650 from the couple's paychecks. Taxes also take their toll. Thanks in part to Kimberly's extra income, the family has bumped into a higher tax bracket, and the government takes 33% of the family's money. So where does that leave Justin and Kimberly after these basic expenses are deducted? With $17,045, which is about $800 less than Tom and Susan, who are getting by with just one income. And we will continue this analysis next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.